Again, today is May 22nd, 2024. And the first thing I wanted to announce is that we are having a Memorial Day sale this weekend. So it will, I believe, start on Saturday and go till Monday. And that's everything on the Dr. Cowan's Garden and drtomcowan.com websites will be on sale. And that's a great time to stock up on items that you've been waiting for. So that will happen this weekend. Another thing, and I was reading some of the comments from the garden video and my diet video. And one thing, there was a confusion about olive tea. And I think people meant thought that I meant that I drink olive oil tea, which I don't. That's not what I do, and I don't even know if that's possible. But on the drtomcowan.com website, we carry something called olive leaf tea, which is made from dried leaves of the olive tree. And this has been used for a long time as a sort of tonic for the circulation. In other words, it helps increase the circulation. So this is particularly helpful in cases of either high or low blood pressure, particularly high blood pressure, because the reason for the high blood pressure is the circulation is weak. And so the body has to clamp down on the blood vessels. And that means the pressure is higher. So it's a compensatory therapeutic response to get the, to keep the blood moving, as it were. So if you help the blood move, in other words, tonify the circulation by drinking a cup or two of olive leaf tea, then your body doesn't have to do an extraordinary measure like raising the blood pressure in order to keep the circulation robust. So that's something anybody with circulation problems should give that a try. The other thing is, there was a bunch of questions on the garden video. Let me just check the YouTube and see if people are getting on. Yes. Okay. Again, I apologize for that. So people asked about electroculture because a lot of people are talking about that and how helpful it is for their plants. And I know a little bit about it, not enough to even really do it. But what I do, and maybe this is what counts as electroculture, is I do have various orgone devices around our house and around our property, and we've had different copper pipes. And we have these long copper pipes, which I pound into the ground at various points of the garden. And some of them have a copper coil that goes from the top that have like a quartz crystal that they hook around or that's embedded into the coil. And so those are at various strategic places of the garden. So maybe that's what we mean by electroculture. If so, then I guess I do it, but I don't do it systematically and I don't really know what I'm doing. I just sort of do it because I have these pipes and I like the way it looks. The other thing that I forgot to mention, which I think of as my kind of secret sauce to the garden, is the way that I water, which is all the watering that I do is by hand using the Aquadea shower head. There's also a garden sprayer that from Aquadea. So they're all are the basically crystals embedded into the head of the hose, not the hose, the shower head attachment, and the water that is used in to water the garden. Obviously, I like it when it's just rain, and so I don't have to water because it takes me about 2 hours sometimes to water the whole garden. So we have a whole house filter, the one from Pure Effects, which basically takes out all the stuff, you know, all the toxins and all the pharmaceuticals. It doesn't take out fluoride, but we don't have fluoride in our water here. And then it goes through a copper vortexing device in the house. And then it goes out to the garden. And then it goes through hoses, which I drag around, and through an Aquadea shower head. And that's what I water the garden with. I have used at various times drip hoses, which a lot of people use and certainly would be, in a way, more efficient and would save me time for sure. But I have plenty of time to do it, and I like doing it. I do it usually first thing in the morning or sometimes in the evening. And I somehow think, even though it's what people would say it's an inefficient way of watering, I somehow think the plants like to have the water falling down somewhere from above rather than just dripped onto the soil. And I know that professional gardeners and professional farmers will probably bristle at that because there's no way they could do that. It's so t very time inefficient and probably in some ways wasteful for the water because it's probably more efficient to just drip it near the root system. But I don't think that's the way that water comes to plants, so I don't like doing it. Whether that's helped my plants or not, I don't know, but our plants are doing well. The other question somebody asked me about is biochar. And I forgot to mention that I do use a fair amount of biochar. So all the beds, maybe not all, but most of them have had biochar. We spread that when we spread the compost. So every time we change the crop, we put a little more biochar and just kind of dig it into the first few inches. We don't actually dig the soil, we just kind of stir it. It's a better way to put it. And so biochar is basically like charcoal, but not made in the usual way that charcoal is made. And even though I've heard a lot about how it's made and have participated in workshops and making it, I don't really know, except they take any sort of organic matter like wood or bark or, old corn stalks, and you heat it up in these essentially air-free stoves is, I think, what the point is. Again, if I get it wrong, that's because I don't really know what I'm talking about. But apparently, by excluding the air, you get this unique kind of charcoal, which arguably is the reason why some tradition, like the, apparently the Amazon forest is rich in biochar and it holds a lot of microbes and nutrients and water in the soil, and it doesn't degrade. So once you do make this biochar, supposedly if you dig it up in 100 years, it'll still be there, although I haven't actually done that, so I don't know if that's true. But I like using it. It seems to aerate the soil and help it have a good texture. And so far, we've had a lot of success, so I keep doing it. I think that's all the questions I had. And now, so now comes the what I call the economic fun, which you may not think is so much fun, but I thought it was interesting. And I thought it was interesting for a couple reasons. The first was this is not a new subject to me. I wrote about the what I would guess you could call the anomalies of money, even back in my Human Heart, Cosmic Heart book, where I pointed out the insanity or the incorrectness, you could say either one, of if you have a government which has a monopoly on the creation of money, which is what essentially we're told is the case. In other words, we're told that the government, the US government, is the sole entity that has the ability to create money. Because anybody else, if they create money, that's called counterfeiting and they can go to prison. So the US government, we're told, creates all the money. Now, they're obviously, probably everybody listening will know that that's simply not true. But let's just go with it for a minute. So if the government creates all the money, which you would expect a government to do, because you would expect that's one of their responsibilities and mandates is to create the currency. And then they have this whole system with the Federal Reserve that's part of the government, allegedly, and that they work together to create the right amount of money and set the inflation rate or the interest rate and the borrowing rate and the borrowing to the banks or the people or whatever. And that's how we're all told that the money is created and for us to use. But then you get into this, and so the question I asked in the Heart book was, well, how come the government has the monopoly on creation of money? Actually, in the book, I pointed out that it can't possibly be the government that creates the money. It's basically the government hands over the power to create money to private banks. So I pointed out that that seems grossly unfair, and that rather they should have handed the money, the power to create the money, over to the Cowan family. And instead of dollars, the money would be called Cowans. And then we would be able to dole out the money as we see fit. Now, it's pretty easy to see that in a system where you have the sole power to create money, let's say, if it was the Cowans who could have the sole power to create money. If I wanted a house and you wanted a house, I would always get the house. Because if they said, well, the house is $500,000, and I said, I'll give you $600,000, and somebody said, I'll give you $650,000, I could keep going up and up to whatever it would take to get the house. And because I don't have to work for the money, I have essentially an unlimited supply of money, because I create the money. Whereas you, poor sucker, you have to work for the money, and therefore you will inevitably have a limited supply of this scarce resource. So I would always win, which is arguably why the banks always win. But the other anomaly of this, which is the central reason why everybody can prove to themselves that it can't possibly be the government that creates the money, is if the government creates the money, how come the government has debt? Because obviously, if it was the Cowan family that created the money, and we had the sole monopoly on the creation of an unlimited amount of money, we would never actually go into debt, because if we needed more money to buy our 20th house, we would just print more money and buy the 20th house. So the question then is, how is it possible, if the government creates money, that the government is also in debt? And so one of the reasons I want to show you this video is because in this documentary, and I know nothing about the history of this documentary or the people who made it, all I saw was this one clip. And there's a couple reasons I wanted to show you this. One is this guy, I guess his name is Bernstein. He is the, I think, chief economist for the Biden administration, in other words, or the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, which would mean he's the chief economist for the federal government. And so you would think he would know about money and things like that. So that's one reason. You'll get to hear what he thinks about this. The second reason is, this is how people should ask questions. And this is what I've been talking about. Every podcast, every interview, every encounter with, in my bailiwick, the health freedom people, they should be asked by people who understand the question, how do you know there's a virus? How does a virologist identify a virus? What is the definition of isolation? And how do they go about doing that? And let's see a paper where they did that. And does that make sense? Every single encounter, they should be made to ask that question in a very similar way as this person makes this Bernstein guy answer this question, and doesn't try to get him off the hook. So take a listen to this, and I think you'll see what I mean. Whoops. I have to share my screen. I'm making all kinds of wonky mistakes here. Oh, I'm not sure if I can hear it. I'm going to go to the YouTube where there's a chat and I'm going to play this. And I'm not sh and you somebody let me know if you can hear this.
Obviously begs the question, why exactly aren't we borrowing in a currency that we print ourselves? I'm waiting for someone to stand up and say, why do we borrow our own currency in the first place?
Like you said, they print the dollar, so why does the government even borrow?
Again, some of this stuff gets some of the language that the MN, some of the language and concepts are just confusing. I mean, the government definitely prints money, and it definitely lends that money, which is why the government definitely prints money, and then it lends that money by selling bonds. Is that what they do? They sell bonds. Yeah, they sell bonds, right? Since they sell bonds and people buy the bonds and lend them the money. Yeah. So a lot of times, at least to my ear with MMT, the language and the concepts can be kind of unnecessarily confusing, but there is no question that the government prints money and then it uses that money to I guess I'm just I don't I can't really talk and I don't get it. I don't know what they're talking about, like, because it's like the government clearly prints money. It does it all the time, and it clearly borrows. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this debt and deficit conversation. So I don't think there's anything confusing there.
Right. I hope you heard that. Whoops. I'm having all kinds of trouble today. All kinds of technical issues. I don't know if people heard that. If you didn't, go and you can put just sort of Google Jared Bernstein on the movie Finding the Money. And it's about a 1 minute clip. And he doesn't seem to know what a bond is or whether the government, how they end up borrowing money. Or it's also possible and maybe even likely that he, in fact, does know, but it would blow the cover on the whole operation, which is basically the government is a money laundering scheme and that they have outsourced to the private banks. So that they can make the money and impoverish the people. But again, one of the main reasons I wanted to show this is this guy is an expert, supposedly. So don't be intimidated by experts. If you are in the audience and have a question, you need to ask it. You need to put the people who are bamboozling us about lab leaks and viruses and medicine. And just about everything else on the spot, make them answer the question just like this lady did, and you'll hear some amazing things. Okay, I think we're all good here. So let's go into some questions. First one, Alex Zek mentioned that you recommended a liver detox protocol that includes castor oil, DMSO, and turpentine. Would you care to share this recipe directions with your viewers, please? So I don't think that's exactly right. I don't use much DMSO because I think DMSO and turpentine are very similar. I have nothing against using DMSO. I have used it in some cases, including intravenously in the past, but I don't have much experience with that. I do use a lot of castor oil packs for liver detox. We carry them, a very good brand, and one that's really easy to use. And it's just the simple directions on the pack is what I do. And the turpentine we went over, that's different. It's not a sort of a one protocol. It's the turpentine is in the way that was described in by Andy Kaufman in our podcast. And there's a whole protocol of preparing yourself with eating a very clean diet and then putting the turpentine on sugar and making sure your bowels are open. And that helps to eliminate fat soluble stored toxins. And the castor oil helps the liver, basically helps conjugation in the liver, which means the making the fat soluble toxins soluble. And then it helps the flow of the bile, which is how the toxins get out of the body through the bile into the intestines and then out through the stool. So we do use those a lot together. I'd use a lot of castor oil packs, and we use turpentine in various ways. And there's nothing particularly special about my directions or recipe. They're the basic turpentine and castor oil directions. Okay. Number two, can calcium be extracted from raw cow's milk? Or is calcification, calcium, not a substance, but rather a process created to poison us slowly? So I'm not sure exactly what the question means exactly, but the first part of the question is, so is there a physical substance called calcium in milk or in anything? And of course, this gets into the whole argument and points I've been making in the last number of months, that this whole model of the atom and physical substance is likely to be incorrect. There is no atomic model that, well, there's a model, but there's no evidence that there's these billiard ball-like particles. But there is something different about calcium and phosphorus and potassium and sodium and sulfur and zinc and all the rest of. These are different, what I would call, so there's essentially two big choices. They're either different particles or they're different energetic states. And of course, it's possible they could be both, but I prefer, since to look at them as they're different energetic states. And so when you put them through a process, you end up getting a signature that tells you this is calcium, whereas this energetic state, which is now, you know, the more rapid the energy, so to speak, that's probably not the right word, the higher the frequency, the less physically solid, substantial it is. The lower the frequency, the more substantial it is. And so when you take different, start with different living things and you measure the lowest, most dense frequencies, some will have the signature that tells you it's calcium, and others have zinc, and others have phosphorus, et cetera. And this is interestingly the basis for the use of the cell salts, because you can essentially extract these so-called substances, but better put dense frequencies from living, you know, living things or even inorganic things. And then you can have the frequency of calc phos or calc sulf or sodium chloride or sodium sulfate or potassium chloride or any of these other cell salts. And they represent different frequencies, which represent different functions in living systems, including us. So the frequency of calcium, which we get the frequency of calcium from a number of sources, including raw milk, helps to essentially nourish our bones and probably make muscles contract and a whole lot of other functions. And that's the energetic imprint or blueprint of calcium. Calcium comes in different forms, and so each of them have a slightly different function. When you take what's called synthesized calcium, you're talking about making the most dense frequencies to have it into essentially a mineral-like rock. And that's not the way the frequencies, the way that living systems incorporate these minerals fundamentally. We incorporate minerals and essentially all substances through their energetic input from living food or from so-called homeopathically energized medicine like the cell salts. So you get the appropriate frequencies of calcium from milk and from bone broth and from a lot of other things, and phosphorus and potassium and all the rest. You can supplement that frequency with cell salts and make stronger bones or healthy blood clotting or muscles contract better because those are the functions. But when you start taking just calcium supplements like rocks, then the body seems to not know what to do with that. And then it stores it as deposits. And then you get calcification in your knee. And then the body doesn't want this rock in your knee. So it uses its only recourse, which is an inflammatory response, to dissolve the calcium in your knee. And then we call that osteoarthritis. So that the root of that problem was the decision to take an inappropriate, i.e., synthetic, i.e., dense frequency source of calcium, which your body then had to deposit somewhere because it doesn't know how to properly use that form of calcium to create to support the function that that calcium would normally support. So it acts essentially like a toxin, gets deposited in your blood vessels or in your joints or in your pineal gland, and your body tries to get it out with an inflammatory response. And that's what we call disease. So you don't want to be eating rocks or that sort of dense minerals. You want to get your minerals from plants, from animals, from like vortex seawater, or from things like cell salts or different herbs, that's plants. You want to use living foods, living medicines, energy frequencies. Okay. When fighting bladder tumors using turpentine, fenbendazole, and laetril, is it normal to discharge tumor through the urine until the tumor is gone? The answer is yes. And Gerson talked about this a lot, especially with gynecological cancers. When you put people on, basically this sort of fasting Gerson diet, basically it was fasting with very raw vegetable juices and liver juice. So it was not a vegan diet by any means. Then you would use coffee enemas. And you would also give some thyroid extract, which stimulate the inflammatory warmth responses, and you would start to get the breakdown of the tumor, and then the body would expel them through the appropriate orifice, in that case, the vaginal opening. So yes, that does happen, and it's basically a good thing, although it obviously can be scary, and people aren't used to stuff coming out of their vagina or bowels that they're not used to seeing, but that's what's happening. So the symptoms of the tumor have reduced dramatically, but it's still occasionally blood or cells in the urine. I would say that is a positive development. I obviously don't know the whole story, but that's how it would work. Okay, number four, please explain causes in recovery from strokes, large and small. The story with strokes is very similar to the story with heart attacks. In fact, it's one of the two organs of your body or tissues of the body that has what we would call attacks. So you have heart attacks, otherwise known as myocardial infarction, and you have strokes, otherwise known as brain attacks. Now, in conventional medicine, they say that the heart attacks and the strokes happen because of blockage of the main blood vessels leading to either the heart or the brain. But as I've talked about many times and may get back into this a little bit, we know that that's not the case, that even in the best autopsy studies of the heart, somewhere about 20% of the people who die of a heart attack, so the worst of the worst, even have a significant blockage in the artery leading to that part of the heart. And that by no means means that the blockage was the cause of the heart attack. It just means it was there. And most of the time, it comes after the heart attack, not before. So it's the same thing with strokes. You do see blockages and plaque buildup in the carotid arteries. Those are the big arteries leading to the brain. But we used to do, we being the medical profession, which is not a we anymore, they used to do carotid endarterectomies where they would peel off the plaque from the carotid arteries to prevent strokes. And they found out that that didn't work and actually gave people strokes. So hardly anybody does that anymore for the very simple reason that that is not the problem. This is not a large blood vessel disease. So the reasons people have strokes are basically the same three reasons that people have heart attacks. So obviously, if it's not the blood vessels, it's and the reason why it's the brain and the heart and not your liver and spleen and kidneys and foot, they don't have foot attacks or spleen attacks, is there something different about the brain and the heart? And the difference is they have the highest metabolic rate, they have the highest number of mitochondria, they have the highest turnover of essentially using energy, and they can't stop. And so the three reasons, even though this hasn't been studied as much with the brain as it has with the heart, are small vessel disease, which is usually a consequence of elevated blood sugar, i.e. diabetes. So you get a corrosion and inflammation of the small blood vessels, which is where the blood flow actually comes from. The second is you have an imbalance in the autonomic nervous system, meaning the parasympathetic and sympathetic balance, which then chokes off the metabolism of the tissues. And these are, as I said, the two highest metabolic organs. So that's anything from stress and particularly fear, which is why fear is such a weapon. So that's the second reason, a decreased parasympathetic tone, which is sort of another way to describe modern life in the Western world. And the third reason, and the biggest reason, is because of the buildup of lactic acid. And this is because of the same problem with the metabolism, and the fuel can't be burned efficiently. And in times of stress, you change to using fermentation, which builds up lactic acid, which acidifies the tissue, and then you get necrosis or breakdown of the tissue, and that happens either in the brain or in the heart. Has nothing to do with plaque in the vessels. And that's the one with both the brain strokes and heart attacks is treated with a better energy generation, a better metabolism, taking care of your mitochondria and strophanthus, which gets rid of the lactic acid buildup by converting the lactic acid into a nutrient, and it breaks that acid-forming cycle and stops the stroke or heart attack from developing. So those are the two main uses, the two organs that have attacks, and they're both amenable to treatment with a healthy lifestyle and the proper use of strophanthus. Okay, in the UK, they're talking about the contaminated blood scandal where supposedly blood was contaminated by Hep C and HIV. What could this actually be? So, obviously, we know there is no such thing as HIV or Hep C or any of the other HEPs. These are fictional imaginary viruses. So basically, what they do is they do PCR assays, which is a meaningless test on the blood. They find sequences which they allege came from Hep C or HIV and then say that it's a contamination. It could be, you probably get more free sequences that would increase reaction with a PCR or antigen or even an antibody test with blood that's particularly toxic and contaminated. So let's just be clear. I'm not saying the blood is healthy. I'm not saying the blood is isn't contaminated. And I'm not saying anybody should take that blood or any other blood unless it's a absolutely dire, life-saving, life-threatening situation. But what I am saying is it's not a virus. It just means the components in the blood are breaking down, which allows it to be picked up with either an antigen or PCR or antibody test, which is fallaciously attributed to a virus, which is then when they see problems in the recipient of the blood, they blame that on the virus, not the state of the person from which the original blood came from. And so, as always, when you get the wrong mechanism, in this case, the fingering a virus which doesn't exist, you end up not being able to understand what the real problem is and the actual state of the person who's donating the blood. And you don't know how to evaluate whether the person is a fit blood donor or not, because all you can evaluate is evaluating imaginary viruses and not the overall health status, because that means nothing to you. Okay. Chronic sinusitis. Modern medicine has failed to treat successfully. They failed to treat everything successfully, so there's no surprise there. Does alternative medicine have better success? Depends which alternative medicine you mean. A lot of alternative medicine would still say you have a fungal infection or a chronic bacterial infection. They might even say that you have a virus. But what you really have is your body's strategy to get rid of stuff it doesn't want. And the color of the mucus is only a reflection of how, quote, nasty the stuff that you have to get out is. So if you have really nasty stuff that you've inhaled or eaten or breathed in some other way or snorted up your nose, and you've got it into your sinus cavities, then you will have green, yellow, foul-smelling mucus and pus coming out of your sinuses, and they call that a bacterial infection. If it's just simply clear mucus, like hay fever or something, then that's not such nasty stuff. It's just birch pollen or something harmless like that. And so the mucus is basically just like uncoagulated albumin from protein from your blood. And of course, once you see it like that, it's very easy to understand that the treatment is stop putting stuff into your body that you're going to need to flush out. And that gets into the diet and your relationship with water and the field. And there are various, treatments, medicines, cell salts in particular, that are very specific and appropriate for helping your body get rid of that which is struggling to get rid of. So I would never use conventional antibiotic, antifungal therapy because that's not the problem. What's your go-to relief, quick healing of ear discomfort, or what a doc diagnoses ear infection and throws in antibiotics to fix it? The thing that I've used for probably 40 years is to put a raw onion pack over the ear. So you just slice an onion and put that on a like a World War I soldier wrap their head with children and put the onion pack right over their ear. And the onion sort of squeezes out the fluid from even behind the eardrum from the middle ear space. You could put garlic drops in, but this is very well tolerated by children. They even sort of like to do it. You just put an onion over their ear, leave it on for even a couple hours. And the reason for the pain is because the middle ear is building up fluid and that's swelling the eardrum. And when the eardrum swells, it causes pain. If you can essentially suck the fluid from behind the ear out through the canal, it will relieve the buildup of the pressure and will relieve the pain. In fact, in the old days before antibiotics, the treatment for middle ear infections was to puncture the eardrum and let the ear drain, which would immediately relieve the pressure and pain. And they still do that, but in a different manner now with putting tubes in the ear. So now they have children who have buildup of fluid in their ear. They say it's a bacterial infection. They give you an antibiotic, and then the fluid stays in your ear. And then, of course, it happens over and over again because it's not a bacterial infection. The bacteria are just there to essentially liquefy the debris and help the healing. But doctors don't know that, so they keep giving antibiotics, and the fluid gets thicker and thicker, and then the child can't hear and keeps getting these infections. And so then they stick a hole in their eardrum, and because the eardrum would close within a matter of days, even, or sometimes even hours, they have to put a tube in to keep it from closing. And there's millions of those operations done per year. And all you do is end up scarring somebody's eardrum, often for life. So a much better way is treatment with onion packs, and probably either I used to use onion packs and lots of liposomal vitamin C about every 15 minutes, anywhere from say 200 milligrams up to 1,000, depending on the age of the child. Nowadays, another option would probably be chlorine dioxide solution, which seems to be like a charge donor. And I know people have been critical of how come I suggest using different sorts of medicines, but when you're in a situation like that and you want to help the child, I have no objection to using something like an onion poultice or vitamin C or a little bit of chlorine dioxide. I use it with the understanding it's not an antibiotic. It's not a toxic substance, as far as we can tell. It just helps with the resolution of those symptoms. And I have nothing against trying to help people resolve symptoms as long as it's working with the way that people heal. Okay. Can you talk about parasites? A lot of people seem to be obsessed with cleansing them. Thanks. I'm not a big fan of cleansing parasites. Again, parasites are just another example of the misguided germ theory. The parasites are there to eat dead and dying tissue and maybe even to eat metallic poisons and other things that shouldn't be there. So if you just stop doing that, and usually with the metallic poisons, it's a reflection of mineral deficiency. So if you address that, then the toxic minerals go away, and then the parasites leave with them because that's their food and they don't need to help you out anymore. And then you don't need to do these parasite cleanses. And the argument that you can prove that parasites are the cause is because if you give anti-parasitic drugs, then people get better, is a irrational way to think, because that doesn't prove it's the cause any more than giving an antibiotic to somebody and then their symptoms resolve proves that it was a bacterial infection, or an antiviral so-called proves it's a viral infection. All it does is, first of all antibiotics and all anti-parasitic agents have many other effects, so you don't even know which of the effects it is. It's not proven that it's just a bacterial effect that's causing the resolution of the symptoms. But even if it is, all you can say is the bacteria were part of the healing process. And if you kill the bacteria, your body can no longer go through that healing process, which means your symptoms will temporarily abate as you have made yourself worse. And that's exactly how you convert an acute healing response into a chronic disease, otherwise known as conventional medicine. So let me finish with this one. This could be a long question, but why don't you promote the carnivore diet? So the reason I promote any diet, or the reason how I the my let's put it another way. The compass that I use to promote a diet is, as best I can understand it, what people have eaten successfully through the generations. And I think the go-to place for understanding the actual epidemiology and the research on this is, of course, the work of Weston Price. He wasn't the only one, but he was the best at documenting what various healthiest people who've ever been studied, who ever lived, and exactly what did they eat. Now, as far as I know, none of the people that Weston Price studied, in other words, none of the healthiest people who've ever been studied, whose health habits and patterns have been documented, ever ate solely a animal food, i.e. carnivore diet. As far as I know, that's true. So as far as I know, there are very few examples. I'll mention the two that I know of a long-lived, well-studied, extremely healthy culture that lived for years and decades and generations on only a carnivore diet. If that's true, then we have no idea really whether that works in for the, you know, for the maintenance of robust health in years and decades and generation after generation. People simply didn't do that, or if they did, they did it and they weren't successful, so they either died out or changed their ways or something. Now, there are some, the two exceptions that I know of are the Maasai, who I think ate only blood, meat, and milk, although they fermented everything. So they ate fermented blood, meat, and milk. And the Inuit people, who lived mostly on seal blubber and other animals that they caught. Interestingly, there's an argument also that one of the foods that even the carnivorous people ate was the stomach of the animals that they caught. In fact, it's likely that they ate every part of it. And just like animals, like cats, I've seen it myself, Pumpkin eating the stomach of the mice that he catches and the rabbits. And so those mice and rabbits have fermented plant food in it, and seems like Pumpkin really likes that part. So you could say, even though Pumpkin's diet is mostly carnivorous, he does eat some grass and some other leaves, and he particularly likes catnip leaves. Even his native diet is in the diet that he sometimes eats when he's not too lazy to hunt, also has some fermented plant food. So my guess is even the Inuit and the Maasai ate some fermented plant food when they ate the animal food, because they probably ate the stomach and the stomach contents. Having said that, I have definitely seen, by the way, as far as I know, there is no vegan culture that you can point to that would qualify as a entry into Price's World's Healthiest People. That simply doesn't exist. If anybody knows one and it's proven and documented, I'd love to hear about it. But as far as I know, that doesn't exist. So the options are a mixed diet, which obviously does include a liberal amount of particularly animal foods and particularly animal fats. There is no diet that Price studied of all these 12 indigenous cultures that didn't eat a liberal amount, in fact, a predominance of animal foods and animal fats. That's not the issue here. The issue is the exclusivity, and that wasn't the case. Again, there's these two examples that I know of. There may be more. And there certainly does seem, and we've been using some of this in our clinic, and I've had more and more people talk about this and show me examples of the resolution of certain medical problems like diabetes and many other things with doing a temporary carnivore type diet. You see weight loss, increased energy, sometimes skin problems clear up. And so, even though that's not something that I ever did as a practitioner, and it's not something I would say routinely used, I do think it is a therapeutic option that probably has some positive benefits for some people. The problem that I would have is I wouldn't know which people it might benefit and which people it wouldn't. So I would probably go by the experience of the person who starts trying it. And I know some people who try to eat a carnivore diet love it and feel great. And with those, I would probably continue. And some just do not feel good. And you could always say, well, they're detoxing or cleansing or something. But it doesn't seem like that. And for those people, it doesn't seem like the right therapeutic maneuver. But again, I am not an expert on using a carnivore diet. I definitely use things like the GAPS diet, which is largely animal food in the beginning, and a liberal Western priced nourishing traditions type animal food diet, but they always had plants. And one of the things that I am very leery about in general and in myself is this fear of food. And so I have basically a practice not to fear eating any type of foods, whether it's grains or fruits or vegetables or fats or meat or chicken or oysters. I eat everything. Of course, not everything, because everything for me, it's all has to be the best oysters and the best beef and the healthiest raised pigs and the best olive oil and the best carrots. The healthiest raised carrots and the healthiest fruits that are, bred and grown to be less sweet and more nutrient dense. And so I don't like to be fearful of food. I don't like to engender that in patients or people who listen to me. So that has also influenced my reluctance to broadly used, very exclusive diets. But there's certainly some interesting things about this and obviously more to look into. So I hope I eventually got the live stream correct and that everybody could see it. I'm not sure that I did, but hopefully I did. And thanks everybody for putting up with my technical incompetence, and I will see you next week.